Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It is Thursday, May 30th, 2013. Well, if you've been working for the FBI, you're going to get a new boss. After completing 12 years of a statutory limited 10-year term, Robert Mueller, former U.S. attorney from here in San Francisco, who took the helm of the FBI just a few days before September 11, 2001, he's finally stepping down. And while I'm relieved, as is always the case, when you see one bad public official leave the government, you have to cringe and say, but will his replacement be worse? And it's a toss-up. James Comey has been named by President Obama to succeed Robert Mueller as director of the FBI. He's a young man, 52 years old, and his background is that he's a Republican who served in the Justice Department under John Ashcroft. As such, he is intimate with the inner workings of the police state that has been expanded since September 11th. The Patriot Act, the national security letters, the surveillance programs, including all the intercepts of telephone and electronic messaging like emails. And there is one episode that runs counter to the overall history of James Comey. I give credit to Rachel Maddow, who did a segment on this on Wednesday night on her program, and brought us the detailed testimony of James Comey before Congress, related to the bizarre incident at John Ashcroft's bedside in a Washington, D.C. hospital. At the Bush White House, they were apoplectic, because Ashcroft had suddenly gone into the hospital without signing the extension of a document that they say provided legal cover for the illegal wiretapping of American citizens in the United States. This was a program that, for whatever reason, the legal beagle said had to be reauthorized by the Attorney General at intervals, I believe, every 6 months. The last extension was about to expire, and Comey related in great detail that he and Ashcroft had had a lengthy conversation and agreed that while they couldn't publicly discuss what the terms of this legal document happened to be, that Ashcroft would not sign the extension, and when he went into the hospital, he made James Comey the acting attorney general, and Comey, taking instructions from his ailing boss, said he would not sign the document either. And reportedly, George W. Bush himself called and spoke to Ashcroft's wife, hovering at his bedside in intensive care, and said that he was sending Alberto Gonzalez, then the White House counsel, later the successor to Ashcroft as attorney general, and a first-class idiot. The guy who said, I don't know, I can't remember, hundreds of times, as senators grilled him before he was confirmed as attorney general. And along with Gonzalez came Andy Card, the White House chief of staff. And James Comey was very concerned that this was going to be a crisis of state. Kind of like when Nixon fired the Watergate prosecutor and went through two attorneys general within a week before he got Robert Bork to sign the document to fire the special prosecutor. And so this showdown is a single moment of some courage on the part of James Comey. He brought in extra FBI guys. He brought in Robert Mueller for protection. It was a pretty big hospital room, pretty filled by the time that Gonzalez and Card got there. They asked Ashcroft to sign the document, hoping that he would be loopy and out of it from whatever drugs they were giving him. Comey recounts that Ashcroft kind of emerged from grogginess and offered a very lucid response to the request from Card and Gonzalez, which was, no. Then he said, by the way, I'm not the Attorney General right now. And he pointed at Comey and said, he is. You got to deal with him. Now, that is a moment of courage on the part of James Comey. He threatened to resign after that rather than sign this extension of the illegal wiretapping. Somehow they addressed his concerns because he didn't resign. And he stayed at the top of our police state apparatus. Even as Alberto Gonzalez replaced his buddy Ashcroft as Attorney General. And for Obama to reach into Republican ranks to select an FBI director who will serve, we know, for at least 10 years, hopefully no longer, but at least 10 years, this is very disturbing. James Comey is briefed into the dark secrets of our nation. He is part of the problem of the creeping police state. In Obama's speech last week, he said it's time to end the perpetual war and the war footing. And I would say that includes our domestic law enforcement apparatus led by the FBI. And so we don't get new blood, we don't get new thinking, we recycle the same bozos. And a pliant Senate Judiciary Committee will ask some really, 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 really tough questions of James Comey and then confirm him for a 10-year run at the FBI. And one of the issues that Comey will have to confront, if and when he's confirmed, is the episode in Orlando, Florida last week, where Ibrahim Todashev, age 27, was being interrogated by FBI agents for his third time. He had been a friend or acquaintance of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother of the brothers accused of running the Boston Marathon bombings, the two episodes, the two explosions. And while the corporate media doesn't cover it anymore, Tamerlan Tsarnaev's death was under very questionable circumstances. It was called a shootout, but it turns out he apparently didn't fire any shots. And likewise, this interrogation that went wrong in Orlando, the FBI's version of events is that we had just gotten him to sign a confession. And the implication is that he flipped out. They first said he had a weapon, now they say he didn't. They say he lunged at or attacked an FBI agent, and they had to shoot him. But we now know from his angry Chechen father, Abdulbaki Todashev, that he was shot 6 times to the body and once to the back of the head. Does that sound like the resolution of the altercation between an unarmed man and several FBI agents in his apartment? Well, I won't speculate much further. But I'll tell you what his father thinks. He thinks they killed his son. I want justice, quote, I want an investigation, he said at a news conference in Moscow. They come to your house like bandits and they shoot you. In the first interrogation, the agents asked him, the son, about the bombing. The second time, they asked him about the triple murder in Waltham, Massachusetts, that police suspect that Tsarnaev might have had some connection to. In the third interview, which took place at Todashev's home and included Massachusetts State Troopers, it ended with his death, according to his father. 7 times they had to shoot him, once in the back of the head because he was lunging at an agent? This begs for a real investigation. Now, take this for what it's worth. They trotted out other people at this Moscow news conference. Maxim Shevchenko, a journalist, member of the Presidential Human Rights Council, quote, this is proof of cold-blooded murder. Zarbek Sadakhanov, a Chechen lawyer, quote, it was an extrajudicial execution, that's a mouthful, I'm going to say that again. It was an extrajudicial execution. Why was he interrogated three times without a lawyer? Why no recording? Why seven shots? Why should I believe their version? Why do American policemen believe they can do whatever they want? The father speculated maybe my son knew some sort of information the police didn't want to get out. They shut him up. That's my opinion, says the father. Well, he deserves answers. And I don't think the FBI should investigate this incident where FBI officers, agents, shot and killed a man they were interrogating. And the corporate media, generally silent. Letters that appear to contain the poison called ricin recently arrived at offices of Mayor Michael Bloomberg in New York and his gun control group in Washington, D.C. Now we know President Obama was targeted by a similar letter. It allegedly is a message to the president with an anti-gun control comment along with a suspicious substance. Late in the day, reports are that chemical analysis rules out ricin. Appears to be a harmless white powder. The letters addressed to Bloomberg came from Shreveport, Louisiana. At least that was the postmark. One was sent to him in Manhattan, intercepted at a mail screening facility. The other to the Washington Office of Mayors Against Illegal Guns. Don't know where this is coming from, but gosh, maybe the FBI can get all over that one. Here in California, we have a troubled nuclear plant, the San Onofre Twin Reactor Facility near San Clemente. It's right along the California coast, north of San Diego. It's been offline for a while now. Hasn't produced electricity since January of 2012. And to her credit, feisty California Senator Barbara Boxer said she has lost confidence in Southern California Edison. I don't have confidence, given what I now know, she told reporters. They ought to just tell the truth. Start now. She said they've been feeding her gobbledygook. And this relates to back-and-forth correspondence between Edison and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, which manufactures the generator part of the nuclear facility. And those generators failed. They have these tubes that seem to be very complicated. And now the lame state PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, is conducting its own investigation. And this is in some ways meaningless because the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission manages the, to the extent there is regulation, of nuclear power plants, not state utilities. But still, the Public Utilities Commission does have purview over California Edison. And of course, the PUC is run by the former CEO of California Edison, Michael Peavy. Isn't that wonderful? And so now the investigation is whether Southern California Edison properly disclosed the letters regarding replacing the generating systems at San Onofre. Cyber attacks from China have reached a new level. The Washington Post reporting a couple of days ago that hackers have breached designs for some of our nation's top secret weapon systems, including missile defense, combat aircraft. It is believed that most of this hacking originates at a 12-story office building in a northern suburb of Shanghai called Gaokuao. And I find this alarming, I have to say. I am concerned. I think China has a very robust and aggressive cyber espionage program. And there's some cyber warfare involved in it, too. But once again, the news account I'm looking at makes no mention of our own aggressive, offensive, cyber warfare and cyber hacking activities. We're the good guys. We never do anything wrong. Oh, yeah, we're the clever people who developed the Stuxnet that infected Iran's nuclear facilities, computer systems. But we're just victims of hacking. And as I've expressed before, I'm very concerned that the cyber warfare we're involved in is just completely off the charts. It doesn't have any congressional authorization. There's no oversight. It just happens. And the blowback that we engender from these kinds of activities is what we're seeing in these hacks that are blamed on China right now. Recently, I pulled out an old tune by the group Sublime and used it to open a podcast about sexual assault in the military. The song is called Date Rape, and it's offensive in many ways. Starts off with a story of a guy who slips a girl a roofie and rapes her, and then it goes into a kind of morality play where he gets convicted, sent to prison. And the band Sublime celebrates that by singing, "Now he takes it in the behind." That this is some sort of justice for the crime that he committed of date rape. And this is offensive on many different levels. But what is most offensive is that last year, it is estimated that 80,000 state prison and county jail inmates experienced sexual abuse, roughly 4% of all prison inmates and over 3% of jail inmates nationwide. High rates of victimization were found among inmates who were gay or lesbian, inmates who had been raped or sexually abused before incarceration, and inmates who suffer from mental illness. It's a very serious problem. But we have this mentality driven by television and Hollywood movies that make it okay for people to turn a blind eye to crimes that occur in prison. After all, everybody there's a criminal, they get what they deserve, right? Lock them up, throw away the key, let them rape each other. That's some sort of sick biblical justice, I suppose. Well, I take a very different view. Sure, just about everybody in a prison is a criminal who deserves to be there. There are exceptions, and I know them well. But the punishment does not include sexual offenses as part of one's criminal sentence. And our jailers and law enforcement officials have an obligation to protect the human rights and the constitutional rights, even those who have been convicted of very serious crimes, even the most heinous crimes. There is no rationalization or justification available, except people who feel that they are able to judge others and apply that judgment by saying that we don't care or you get what you deserve if you get raped in prison. More disturbing efforts to prevent information coming out of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut last December. We've told you about Connecticut's new state law, quietly run through the legislature. I don't think it's been enacted yet. But it proposes to pull a big dark curtain over release of information related to the victims and the sequence of events that occurred at the Sandy Hook School. They're saying that this is to protect the families from truthers who would exploit this information. And yeah, some of the people lumped into the truther category are nuts who want to pretend that Sandy Hook was part of some big scheme to create hysteria about gun violence so that Obama can take away your guns. It's bullshit. But the questions about what happened at Sandy Hook are not. The initial media reports suggested there might have been a second shooter. We're not allowed to ask about that anymore. The initial media accounts say that Adam Lanza was buzzed into the school. Later they said he shot his way in. There are discrepancies in reports that the Bushmaster rifle that he allegedly used to mow down students and teachers at Sandy Hook was still in his car when law enforcement officials found it and opened it up. Now, I wasn't there, and I am not proposing any specific theory or saying that I know what happened that conflicts with what has been reported. But once again, the official narrative is suspect, and officials are moving to block the disclosure of information that ordinarily would be readily available to the media and the public. What do you got to hide, Newtown? There is no justification for blocking access to public information. And finally, today, here in California, where earthquakes happen once in a while, we live with that threat. The legislature has passed unanimously in the Senate a bill to develop an early warning system for earthquakes here in the Golden State. They're ponying up $80 million of taxpayer money for a network of seismic detection instruments designed to provide up to a full minute's warning wherever and whenever a damaging earthquake starts to move across the state. Now, a minute is not a lot, but if you just have 10 seconds notice, you can take some cover. You can improve your position in the building where you are or get out of the path of falling debris or things that could fall down. And so even if it's just a few seconds and we develop a system where you get a text message or other alert, it can save lives, reduce injuries, and probably won't make much difference about property damage. They say the system will cost about $10 million to operate and includes GPS devices and seismometers located across the state, linked to a computer network so that we can be alerted as soon as signals are received. I think it's a good idea, and I hope that Governor Brown will sign that bill into law before the next big earthquake here in California. Hey, thanks for grabbing my news and comment podcast today. You are authorized to share this free podcast with absolutely anyone. With my gratitude, I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.